I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. Are you ready to win at the game of life? Well, throw out that rule book and get down to the business of being the best and most authentic version of you. Welcome to the Human Design Podcast. We're changing the rules around success, abundance, purpose, love, and life, where we're creating a planet where everyone can thrive in a world that loves and supports each other. I'm your host, Emma Dunwoody, a qualified master coach, human design expert, podcaster, and entrepreneur that is living the life of my dreams, breaking all the rules while doing it, making a huge impact, and living my design and manifesting miracles on the daily. Join me as I break down and simplify everything you need to live in alignment with your human design, teach you how to recondition your unconscious mind for greatness, and to take back your power so you can manifest your heaven on earth and serve the rest of the planet at the same time. It's time to give up the fear and step into your highest potential, to reach for the stars, to know and live your greatness. It's what you deserve, and it's what the planet really needs from you. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Hey, hey, everyone, and welcome to today's episode. Well, today I have just a brilliant guest, someone whose books I have read, and at the moment, she doesn't know this yet, but I've literally split up from my husband last year, and I'm like, God, I want this book. Like, can this book hurry up and come out? So I have just loved everything that you've done. So Dr. Nicole LaPera, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Emma. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. I was saying just before I hit record, before I knew your design, I was like, this woman has to be a line three, because as I'm reading your books, you're sharing your personal experience. And, you know, it's that part of me that just goes, oh, that just, I don't know, that the realness of hearing your own personal experience with all of your knowledge and expertise is just the thing that really grounds it for me. So thank you for being you.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that. It's been such a evolutionary journey in myself, trying to integrate myself as professional, right? And all that I'm passionate and purposeful about, and myself as individual. And for a very long time in my initial stages of the journey, I very much was taught by my field of clinical psychology to not bring the human. And I think it's done the field itself quite a disservice for a lot of us clinicians who intuitively knew that removing our personal experience removed a huge aspect of the relational experience of being in therapy that is actually therapeutic and healing. So anytime I hear affirmation, especially when I do share, because so much of it still does feel personal. And yeah. I do have a lot of conditioning and protection around, well, what will people think as I share these aspects of my own journey outside of course, just people who would want to work with me. So thank you for affirming that is a beneficial aspect of the work that I provide.
Oh, you're so, so welcome. And for all the listeners out there, I know you're wondering, what is Nicole's design? She's a 1-3 emotional generator. And Incarnation Cross is the cross of Eden. And when I saw that, I'm like, of course it is. Because again, I've read your books and I've heard a lot of your story. And the cross of Eden is all about this, as a child, metaphorically, you get thrown out of Eden and your journey is to then recreate your Eden. And then as you go on as an adult, then you help others create their Eden. And I'm like, that sounds a lot like what you do. So for those listeners that maybe don't know you or your work, obviously they've been under a rock, but hey, maybe they haven't. I would really love you to share your story, because I often talk about, you know, we have that catalytic moment. Often people will refer to it as the dark night of the soul. As a line three like me, you've probably had a few of them. You know, like that catalytic moment where actually it was that invitation to your purpose. It was that moment where, okay, I'm not going to just wallow in this and be the victim. I'm going to make a different choice. And I would love to hear that story and kind of obviously the short version, because I'm sure that's a very long version of that, that took you up until today, up until this point where you used the things that maybe were your greatest challenges to actually become someone who is now aligned to their purpose and serving the planet with those initial challenges.
It's so funny because even hearing you say, you know, kind of where did this begin, purpose, you know, words like that, my dark night, again, another conceptual word that I now use very frequently, was not language that I had had about probably a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago, when I started to feel what I now understand to be a dark night of the soul. And without that language, I felt really disempowered and very confused, because the time point at when I started to feel really disconnected, really just like heavy, really low, I would fantasize about moving away, leaving this world I had created, because as you're kind of like sharing in terms of collecting, you know, letters after my name and certifications and my interest. And I'd gotten to the end of that journey of seeking information, seeking, you know, what I was going to do when I grew up. Though I would have never used words like I felt purposeful, I felt passionate about what I was doing. Even though I was really marching on the pathway of becoming a clinical psychologist for as long as I can remember, really being driven by a desire to understand other people, sent me into the field where I thought that that was what I was going to be doing in the room, tasking, you know, individuals with insight and awareness that would then allow them to create change. And several years then into having that practice, I started to feel very disempowered, because that was not the experience that I was seeing working with my clients. And that was also not the experience that I was having myself. I was very much, again, struggling without the language. And until I understood that what I was experiencing was a result of all of those conditioned ways that I was showing up in the world, seeking achievement, right? Almost in a survival-driven way, trying to define and get some sense of self, resulted in, of course, I didn't have a purpose, a passion. I was really locked in survival mode, like a lot of my clients. And of course, I gained this language that I now speak from a very much holistic perspective, from that really low state of, for me, it was, well, how do I solve this problem? How do I become a clinician? It wasn't even about me individually at first. It was, how do I become someone who is better at what I do? And thankfully, I dove down the rabbit hole of all of the information that is available on the internet. And I learned a whole lot about the human body and our nervous system and how deep our conditioning goes, and started to now have language like, oh, dark night and conditioning, and really then start to create the framework of what I now reference as holistic psychology and the way that I now share and teach.
I just love that, because I think one of the things for me, this, you're almost like a pinnacle person in my experience of, and my journey as well, from a perspective of, like, I always wanted to understand why we do what we do. I mean, my moment came when I was diagnosed 20 years ago now with depression and panic disorder, and told that I was going to have to live with it for the rest of my life. And gratefully, there was something deep inside of me that was like, nope, nope. And I ended up qualifying as a master coach. So I spent 3 years diving into every facet of human behavior. And the reason I didn't go down the psychology road was because I felt it was constrictive. You know, they're like, we learned all the same things, we just could do different things with it. So when I started to really dive into your work, I was like, oh, thank God, because over the time, I've now worked with so many psychologists that have, you know, come out of psychology and into coaching, because they want to be a part of the journey. They want to, you know, give direction. They want to, you know, help more than potentially the old school model was helping. And I think that what is so beautiful about your work is that you're giving the psychologist the permission to step out of that conditioned structure and actually be like, yeah, there's more I can do here.
And that's I just think so needed and so refreshing, because I am by no means the first person, the first clinician who, right, came to these shifts in their own practice. And honestly, the gift of beginning to share my story is challenging and threatening and scary. It felt as I first started to put myself out there on social media as a therapist, a psychologist, of course, as a human as well. And right, starting to share all of this, there was a lot of concern, particularly for me, around what would my colleagues think. Even coming from, you know, the new school in New York is very at the forefront in terms of it didn't just teach us the gold standard of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I learned interpersonal therapy in a much more integrated model. So here I am like, well, how can I be at such an integrated program? And yet I didn't hear about any of this. So then what will clinicians think of me? And the gift, honestly, of sharing myself more publicly was hearing from all of the other clinicians from quite literally around the world that were feeling similarly as frustrated and beginning to expand, whether it was structurally by saying, oh, I'm not even a psychologist anymore, I'm a coach so that I can, or just beginning to expand the boundaries in their own work. So for me, that was really affirming. Yeah. Because I did have that instinctual awareness that I was as I always had felt a little bit, even from my years within the program, I was always the student that was a little bit more on the outside, was always trying to integrate things or understand all the different ways of practicing as opposed to just this. So it kind of fits.
Yeah.
That now here I am yet again, though what I am proud of doing in this moment is staying grounded in what my truth was and not just allowing that fear to take over, because hearing the affirmation from all of the other clinicians was, especially in those early stages when I was a bit unsure and uncertain, that was so grounding for me.
Yeah. And I love that. And just a little bit of human design geek out. One of the big roles that a line three has on planet Earth is to call out what doesn't work. They're the ones that actually are the ones that kind of throw themselves at things. They have the experiences, they make a mess. But they're kind of like, yeah, this doesn't work, you know, and I'm a three, five. And it was the, for me, it was all about mental health. I was like, hang on a second, you're telling me one thing, but that's not true because all of these studies and research is telling me something very different. So I love that, you know, like we can't make this stuff up, you know, human design is something that guides us. It's not our identity. It's not who we are, but it's really helps us get in touch with the energy that lives within us. Now, it's almost like I don't know which direction to go in. So many questions, so many places. Almost selfishly, I want to dive into your new book, which is, of course, How to Be the Love You Seek. Even when I saw the title, I was like, oh, my God, like even the title is groundbreaking because it presupposes that it's the individual, it's me that gets to choose the love I receive by being me, the version of me, as opposed to that conditioned thing that we are looking for something external of us. So tell me a little bit, like, what was the inspiration for the book? Why did you specifically want to focus on relationships?
The focus for me was, again, another kind of intuitive extension, not only in my own individual journey, but in the client work I was doing, because I had seen from the start of my practice a lot of couples and family. So I was kind of integrated in watching and, again, similarly task to, you know, help create communication, you know, help solve conflicts. And much like I was experiencing in with my individual clients and my individual work, the couples I was seeing were still struggling, did not seem to matter how much insight and awareness and beautiful communication we would have within session. The cycles of dysfunction, of course, would continue to be repeated. So seeing, again, similar in my own experience, was intuitively then, oh, let me think and write about why it is then that relationships are kind of the last frontier of challenge. Even those of us that are and have been on our awakening, our healing journey, and we're starting to feel, you know, grounded and present and affirmed in ourselves, and then yet we're still struggling within our relationships. So really, again, so much of it, of my interest in psychology really was framed around, well, how are our early experiences in particular impacting? And especially when we're talking about the conversation around relationships, the answer is foundational. The impact is how we are learning to relate not only to ourselves, to other people, begins in those earliest relationships. And for a lot of us, continues to create this endless seeming cycle of chasing, of dysfunctional cycles, of, again, no amount of insight and even supportive friends can help us create the changes in the dynamics because they are so learned. Some of us have identities wrapped around these early ways of being or self-expression that worked in a particular environment, though for a lot of us just continue to keep ourselves disconnected, which is why so many of us are walking around. Even if we are in relationship, we don't feel supported. We don't feel truly authentically known or connected or that attunement, that feeling, that felt sense of being in a relationship that I think so many of us are looking. And so we kind of follow a very developmentally immature framework, which is this idea that if I just find this right person, I will somehow feel differently, even though the reality of it is we will continue to find the familiar person, mm-hmm. right? And be the familiar person or play the familiar role, no matter how much we want different, until, of course, we become aware of how deep this programming goes and, of course, integrate our body, which is a lot of this book kind of frames this journey around our nervous system and how pivotal and foundational that plays even within our relationships. So that, of course, we can begin to, as the subtitle says, break those dysfunctional cycles for the first time.
I just love it. Like personally, as I'm going through this experience, I'm super grateful because, you know, it's not like I've completely stopped, for the want of a better word, my dysfunction. But I will often say to a friend of mine, I'm like, I can just see my dysfunction playing out. So I'm making different choices, you know. It's like I still do the thing, but I'm conscious about it. So I don't follow through. I don't say the thing. I don't take the action. I'm like, oh, there it is. And I'd love to dive into this a little bit. I'm just going to quickly go via human design on a couple of points. And that is that we often say, like, we will marry or be in relationship with the chart, the design of our parents, because it's the energy we've got so used to being around. And before I was ever into human design, I was very aware that I'd married my mother. And I, you know, and he is very similar. His design is very similar to my mother's design. So, of course, when I discovered this, I'm like, oh, my God, you cannot make this stuff up. Like, cannot make this stuff up. So the other thing I just wanted to touch on from a human design perspective, and really what this book is about as you dive into the nervous system and feeling and the body and bringing all of that into the brain, the mind, behavior. As we move into this new paradigm, one of the, and the new paradigm is, like, you might have heard of things like the Age of Aquarius or all of these different spiritual or other modalities, these leaders, they talk about this time, 2026, 2027, there's this big shift. And from a human design perspective, we talk about the new paradigm in 2027. And one of the governing energies that's coming in is this energy. It's called the Gate 59, and it's the gate of intimacy. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing right now is the breaking down of man, woman, husband, wife, procreation to I love this other person, you know, and kind of, although we're in this time right now where we have to attribute labels to almost differentiate the differences, in this new paradigm, what, you know, from my perspective and a lot of people in the human design world, we're going to move to this time where it's just about, like, there will be no labels. It'll just be like, I do love this person. This person's my person. It doesn't matter what the gender, you know, what it does. None of that matters, because it's no longer about procreation. It's about intimacy. So I love that this work, a lot of your work is like breaking all of these old rules, because that's what they are, or beliefs, which, and beliefs are nothing more than convenient assumptions, and breaking these rules and actually diving deeper into the felt energetic experience of being a human. So first of all, is there anything there that you want to respond on? And then let's dive into, why do we keep marrying our mother?
That's, yes, absolutely. And, you know, jokes aside, I'm now sitting here thinking and wondering and wishing I knew what my parents' human designs exactly were, and I probably will go figure that out. But yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the most frustrating things, especially for the many of us who look back, maybe not so fondly on our childhood, and even affirm to ourselves, commit even, that we will not repeat those habits, those dynamics. We will not cause that same pain. And inadvertently, a lot of us end up in some way or not carrying that pain, and either picking the same person or repeating that cycle in some way or not. And again, I speak to this because I think within this, a lot of us carry a lot of shame then, especially, and again, just bringing the conversation back to the nervous system, when, if and when we are consistently overwhelmed with a stressful experience, and for a lot of us, that overwhelming stress stays near consistent for a lifetime. And if our nervous system then does what naturally any nervous system will do, it goes into that shutdown state where we lack motivation. We can't advocate for ourselves. We can't set or even define or defend a boundary, right? Let alone make sure that we're caring for our boundaries and making sure that our needs are being met. So speaking to that, because particularly in relationships, if and when those moments of shutdown happen, and some of us live in that moment, a lot of dysfunctional, even abusive patterns can be repeated. And we quite literally then wonder what might be wrong with us that we can't leave. And the reality, again, lives for most of us within our nervous system state, that to some extent and very real degree, we can't physiologically leave in this state. We need to resource ourselves, create supportive opportunities, experiences. One of the biggest reasons why I created an online community that then became a membership, right? Because I do need to resource myself to be able to break some of these habits and patterns. So for those reasons and the shame, I think that a lot of us carry because of how we've learned to relate to ourselves or to someone else, makes this conversation in particular so incredibly important, especially as I'm very inspired hearing, could not agree more that, you know, humanity is moving toward a more unified, you know, hopefully more interdependent, harmonious way of being truly intimate with another, which means truly in presence of them, even when they are categorically different than us. So I'm having chills as I'm saying all of this, and just loving the alignment of universal energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that word. I really want to go into interdependence because I don't know if you've heard of the gene keys, but it's a sort of another modality that's kind of aligned to human design. And Richard Rudd is like this epic human that channeled this information. And I think that potentially, I mean, with my training, yes, but sort of with his work, I started to really get a grasp on what interdependence actually looks like. You know, like what's the lived experience? I would love you to talk to that, because ultimately interdependence is the goal for any relationship, correct?
In my opinion, I mean, I think in all opinions, an interdependent relationship is the most harmonious, most sustainable, most efficient system in general. So I think even maybe scientifically, I wrote a little case in there that yes, it's ideal.
I love it. So tell me, what is it? What does it mean to be interdependent in a relationship?
And I love this, because even breaking down some of these definitions, I think, again, so many, I said, well, what do you mean? I've heard this word. Interdependent, simply, as I often simplify definitions, means to me our ability to retain our separateness, our uniqueness. I can be me while in a relationship in consideration of you and your differences, your different perspectives, your different wants, needs in any given moment, or whatever it might be. And that's what an interdependent relationship looks like, where it is the space where there isn't, on the other end of that spectrum, then compromising or codependence, or I and my sense of self is defined by you in whatever way, because we think alike, because I tend to your feelings, because of the role I play, in any version in between. So
yeah,
interdependence is really built on the foundation of safety and security, where I feel safe enough to be who I am. And then I extend that feeling, energetic sense that I'm actually talking about here, of signals that my nervous system and heart is sending out, creating then the energetic experience of possibility for someone else to truly, authentically express themselves. And then, of course, that dynamic of exchange, right? Where, yes, sometimes there are conflict. We don't agree, right? We might negotiate whose needs are prioritized in this moment, though it is still two individuals joined together, right, looking forward in the same direction of a future where both people, because I like to add that part in, because I think some people, when I hear interdependence, immediately mean like a transactional, well, I did this, so you do that. And energetically, that's just not what exact, we're not looking for the immediacy of it. It's more in the system of exchanging and giving.
Yeah, I love that. And the question, and the reason why I'm going to just take a step back, is the reason why I asked this question is, you know, in my experience, my husband and I were married nearly 24 years. We're still good friends now. We're navigating out of it, you know, in the best way possible. One of the things that in the past we've been to, you know, couples therapy, and the reason why for me it was a large part of like, I don't want to go there again, is because I actually felt like it wasn't helping. In fact, it was making it worse. All I would end up doing is turning myself inside out to be someone that this therapist and thought I should be, and he needed me to be. And I could never work out the balance. Like, how do I be me and take care of his needs? And I remember reading, can't remember which book it was. It was like, you need to take even one more step back. You need to first be in relationship and say, these are my needs. And the next question is, can you actually fulfill my needs and have this ability to have that conversation in the first place? So I would just love to hear your take on, all right, if we're going to have interdependence, that's also going to mean, and we're in this functional relationship that feels great and it helps us grow and evolve. So that also means that there is going to be conflict at times, because growth comes from that. Let's talk about needs. Like, how do we make sure that our needs are met and that their needs are met in an interdependent environment?
I think the most important place to start is to acknowledge needs in general, that we all have them, and what they are. Because again, needs is one of those words, I laugh. When I was writing the proposal for this book, and the concept of needs came up, and kind of my agent was like over my head being like, and he's such a great wealth of feedback in terms of when I give him, you know, pieces of work like this. And he's like, you really got to like describe needs though. And he really brought to like the forefront of my attention, the reality that, again, another common word, right? We all say need this and need that. And right, there's needs we have, and we even make demands. I need you. But I think we're a bit unclear on what a need is. And some of us are even unclear that we have the right to have needs in a relationship. So
yeah,
that big piece is the first step of the journey, identifying that I am an individual who does have individual needs, and then becoming aware or present to ourselves in action as we go about our daily life to determine if and when our needs have any space within our day-to-day existence individually on our own and or within our relationships. And so in terms of our physical body, I mean, quite universally, our bodies universally need more or less the same minimal requirements, right? We need oxygen, we need nutrients for our cells to run. We need calm moments of rest and sleep at night to repair and replenish, right? And we need to move to discharge our energy, right? Those are the core basic needs. And I can even map those onto what our nervous system needs to be able to function and keep ourselves in that calm, grounded presence. Then emotionally, we all share, again, quite similarly, the need to be supported, to be seen, to be able to express ourselves emotionally within our relationships, because our emotions make up part of who we are, right? In that interdependent model, allowing myself space to have an emotional experience within our relationships. So becoming present to needs exist. We all have them, even if we do become aware that there isn't space for me to meet them, or I'm suppressing my needs to serve or care for someone else or prioritize someone else first, right? But we have to see first and foremost, needs can be had. We are the one who's not creating the space or participating in the absence of space for that need in our relationship. And then that could give us the possibility of, for some of us, exploring what our needs might be, because we become so practiced at worrying about everyone else. I know for me, it looked as even silly as I couldn't tell you when asked what I wanted for dinner, what I would want to put on my dinner plate, because I was so used to just deferring. Well, what do you want for dinner, right? What is your body telling you? What taste do you have? Not knowing that, well, my body is sending me signals all day long too. Right. And I can visualize different meals and my body gets excited by one and not excited by another, but I'm just removed myself completely from the decision of what my body needs. Right. So in small micro moments, for a lot of us, it's creating space to then attune and discover. So curiosity, I like to really emphasize too, because I think a lot of us have this idea. Oh, okay. Needs happen. I have somewhat of an idea. Our body needs things. I need emotional support. Right. So then we kind of like assume that we just know then what our body needs and how we need to get supported. And that's not true, right? We have to explore and experiment uniquely what my body needs in terms of rest and movement or nutrients, and what then registers to me as feeling supported versus not. And then of course we can engage in a question, conversation, exploration around, is it equal, right? Kind of that other topic, right? Needs, like who gets to meet needs. So first, once we locate ourselves an individual that has needs, right, then determining how and when we can meet them within our environments. And then, of course, determining if and when the person, and this is a relational space of giving and receiving.
Yeah, I love that. And you know what? The thing that I'm curious about, I've often wondered this myself, which, you know, probably says a lot about the sort of things I've had to heal, is like, how do I know if, A, it's actually a need or it's a conditioned response? You know, like sometimes I've been like, is that really a need, or is that something I think I need because I've been taught that I need it, or I've been taught more so in my case that I don't need it, so I disregard it? And I've often wondered, like, so, and this is probably more in the realm of like your emotional needs. You know, do you really need someone to listen to you extensively, tell the same story 3-4 times, or is it an unresourceful just playing out of a pattern that actually needs to change? So I'd love to hear your response to that. Is like, how do I actually know what I do need, and if this is something that's resourceful for me, and if maybe it's something that I'm just playing out from my conditioning?
This is your monthly reminder to go to the show notes and check out the Body Graph Chart software. I know you've heard us talk about this before, so I'll keep this very short and very sweet. But if you want to know the tool that we've used to bring in over 20,000 new leads and five figures in passive revenue into our business, then go check it out. It's amazing. Stop sending people away to other people's websites to get their human design chart. Instead, use this tool to put it on your own website. You won't regret it. And use the code Human Design Podcast, all lowercase, all together, Human Design Podcast, to get 50% off for a year.
That's a really, really great question. And I like to think of this journey as a kind of an unpeeling, right? The onion kind of analogy, because there isn't any objective way to determine, like for me to say, oh, well, here's are the markers to know or distinguish, differentiate, whether it's conditioned, learned need, if you will, or real need, yeah. Right? It really is kind of a peeling back and a less, more of a kind of drilling down, if you will, because there's a difference or a distinction between, right, the need. So for this instance, right, this person who needs to tell the story possibly several times over, what is the core need, right? The core need in that moment might be hypothetically, just use this example, the person's upset. They want to feel less alone in their upset. They want to feel seen in their upset. That's usually, we want some felt sense when we're in an emotional experience. This is typically what we're needing when I say support. And we want to share that space with someone else. We don't really want a solution to our problem, right? We don't really need to say it four times to get that solution. What we really want is the feeling of being seen and supported or less alone in our upset. So when we understand the core need, right, to feel seen, to feel heard, to feel like someone is acknowledging that I'm upset right now, then I think we can get a little more flexible in how that upset, because then we start to, then is a conversation, well, what have I learned to do with that upset, right? What is the conditioned behavior? Is it that I've learned to tell the story seven times because then it gets heard if I keep increasing my volume? Or have I learned not to show that there is any upset, right? My conditioning might have said, do the opposite, right? I'm the problem. No, nothing's wrong at all, right? Hide my upset, right? So then it's a matter of the core need is still there. I'm still upset and I still want to be seen, but now I can have clarity that needing to tell it seven times, right, versus stuffing it away and hiding it. Those were learned behaviors, because what most of us notice when we tell it the seventh time, we still don't feel better, yeah. Right? When we act like, yeah, we're okay and we're really not, we still don't feel better, right? Because until we get that felt sense of energetic attunement or entrainment, literally where our two energetic bodies are now vibrating together in this upset, then we feel less alone, and then our need gets met. So until, again, we have the ability to observe ourselves, like you described at the beginning of our conversation, Emma, right? I see myself. I will be the first to admit, I sometimes see myself in action very dysfunctional ways. I don't hit stop before. I'm saying the thing, it's coming out of my mouth, and I'm like, oh, I'll feel bad about that later, right? So
yeah, there it
we
goes.
Have to, though, watch those kind of, yeah, layers of our conditioning to then determine what's driving it, and then to get clear on, oh, wait, this is still a need. I'm really not feeling attuned in this moment. What you're, yeah, offering me isn't working. It's not about me saying it the right amount of times or not. I'm not getting that felt sense versus, oh, well, if I lose this learned rule, right, that doing it this way or not doing it this way gets my need met, now I might expand myself to the possibility of actually getting that need met, of someone being with me, yeah, in my emotional experience.
I love that. And I think, like, I just want to add, I know in my experience, one of the big things for me is support. That's been a big part of my relationship. And, you know, even to the point where over the years, I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to get supported the way I want to be supported from him, so I'll just do it myself. And what's happened is, like, I've taken on the role over all the years thinking that, well, if I do all the things and I don't need the support, then it'll all be good. Like, we'll be fine. Right. But now I just find myself at this point where I'm like, well, I know I can do it all for myself, but it's not what I need. That's not actually fulfilling my support needs. So I think it's also being super aware that, I mean, and yes, both you and I are line threes, which means we're going to experiment, we're going to do things, and we're going to get to a point and go, nope, that's not it, so that we can choose something different. And I think that that's also through this whole process is being open to continuing to experiment and try new things. And like you say, like continue to take the layers off and And I just had an epiphany while you were speaking. I'm like, so in the gym, I have this thing when I'm in the gym, I've done it my entire life. In fact, I also do a dressage, like an equestrian sport, done it all my life at a really high level. And I've never understood, like, trainers, teachers, coaches, they push me and they push me and they push me. And I'm like, I can't do any, like, why? And it's literally as you're speaking, I'm like, because my face says I'm fine the whole time, because I was raised by a mother that doesn't show emotion. So the whole time, my face, even though my body is screaming out, I'm just
can't
like,
they tell I'm dying? And no, the reality right? is no. Wow, it's yeah. Like,
That makes so much sense, far out. Now, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, so I want to be conscious to stay on track because I do tend to deviate, as you may have guessed. I want to talk about attachment style, and then I really want to go into, you talk a lot about heart-brain cohesion. Now, this is an area that I want to talk about as well, and the role that the heart plays in all of this, and how that, connected to our nervous system and all of these experiences. But just very selfishly, I want to talk very quickly about attachment style, because obviously attachment style and attachment theory was a big thing. It was very trendy for a while as it all came out. And I'm a dysfunctional attachment style. So is my husband. Obviously I'm one and he is the other. My simple question is, like, can I ever heal this shit? Like, can I ever be a secure attachment style? Please say yes.
I appreciate you asking, because this question is very common. And attachment styles, I like to think about, anytime I categorize something, they are helpful, oftentimes markers of where we are, giving us the opportunity to absolutely, yes, I see everything on a spectrum in terms of attachment. That's why sometimes I'm even hesitant to, while I do know that there is incredible research kind of citing the specific attachment styles and a million different factors of what develops them and what they change into. But my concern always is kind of boxing ourselves in, either thinking that it's something that just we're genetically predispositioned to, right? This idea of attachment, something inborn, we can't change it. I would make the case that we learn all of the different ways of relating to ourselves in those earliest environments. So absolutely, it was a learned experience, which then means that it can be unlearned and it can be changed. So, and I have yet to meet, I will go ahead and throw this one out there as well, I'm waiting for the, what I call unicorn to slide into my DMs, because I've honestly yet to meet a truly securely attached adult because of all of the different generational lack of resources, lack of information. I mean, so much has just changed over decades of time that very few of us in adulthood now were raised by parents that had the tools and information and resources to give us that environment to have true safety and security that we need in terms of attachment. So a lot of us are in the same journey that you are doing
I'm
the work
so glad
to create
that you
it.
Said that, because I've often wondered, I'm like, is like secure attachment even a thing at the moment? Because change is happening so fast, and our consciousness is rising. Therefore, our children's consciousness is already ahead of ours when we're having children. Like, it's just all so quick. So there's always been part of me like, is there actually any secure attachment people out there? And I'm sure there are. And I love that. Yes, you can. It's a learned behavior. It's funny. I said this in my membership community just this week. It's a learned behavior. So don't attach it to your identity. Even though I just said I am. No, I'm not. I am not. I have done. So let's talk about, do you know what the other thing I just want to very quickly geek out, human design perspective, is that one of the places in our chart from a gene keys perspective is called our core wound, and then that becomes our vocation. So it's kind of like this theme that is seated within us when our consciousness comes into the body 3 months before we're born. It will in the beginning be a very significant challenge of ours, but then as we mature and we work with it, it becomes our core talent, becomes the thing that we then share with the world. And for you specifically, you have the gate or the gene key 18 in your vocation, which is fascinating, because the shadow of the 18 is judgment. And this is like judgment of self, like the fear of judgment sits in there. The fear of authority sits in there. It's a lot of self judgment. And then it moves up into the gift of integrity. And integrity, and I think one thing that I talk a lot about with my audience, with my clients, is that many of us have learned to be in integrity with others. So if we make a promise to others, we'll keep the promise, but we're out of integrity with the self because we keep breaking the promises to ourselves. And like reading your books, I'm like, wow, there it is. And then the siddhic state, so the enlightened state. It's like that we get these flash of these moments. For you, it's called perfection, and it's not the mental perfection that we know of. It's the perfection of nature, and everything in nature is a little bit different. Although it's the same, it's just perfect in its differences. So I think it's epic that this, again, like, you can't make this shit up. Like, this is your core talent, and I feel like this is what you're doing in the world. Do you want to respond to that? Does that feel like it resonates?
I'm feeling, honestly, I'm a little emotional. Something when you said about nature and everything a little different, that has been such a struggle in the more traditional sense of perfection that I've been really kind of obsessively striving for, to the extent that I remember a time back when I was younger, you know, adolescent, teenagers, really through my 20s, anytime, and I was athletic, so I played sports a lot. I would throw my body around, so I have scars. And any time, whether it was a scar on my body, or I think I share this in this book too, or a stain, right, on my clothing, it would throw me into this near obsessive need to, and especially scars on my body, which were much more difficult to remove. I mean, I would obsessively focus on them. So hearing that, obviously I've continued to heal that wound, and now I have wild scars that I wear very proudly, and I'm all tattooed and they're not perfect, and I've made peace with all of that, and it becomes now an opportunity. But so I felt very moved kind of just hearing and seeing that conflict really reflect it, and my progress, of course, on that journey.
I love that. You know, I think one thing that I often say to the people that I'm working with is, so often that thing that we're trying to fix in ourselves is just the fear expression of our greatness. And I think that in this is another great example of that, you know, trying to be perfect or fix the perfectness. But really, when you come at it from love, you know, what is perfection from that higher consciousness state? Well, it's your differences. It's the things that make you different and unique. So, yeah, just another example that so often we're trying to fix things that are actually our greatness.
Us, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about cohesion in the heart, because I know we hear a lot about this. Like Dr. Joe Dispenza talks about it a lot. I know for me, I do not meditate at all anymore without having my hand physically touching my heart space and having that conscious moment. I think it's 90 seconds where you can bring the heart and the brain into cohesion. So can you talk about that and why it's so important to understand the role that the heart plays with and the brain, because I think we do focus a lot on the brain when it comes to behavior.
Absolutely. I mean, we focus predominantly on the brain when it comes to behavior. Then I learned a whole piece of information, including the body, though, that was very specifically focused on our nervous system and the kind of the concept of neuroception. Listeners might have heard this, kind of the way our body kind of evolutionarily is always scanning, always assessing the safety of our circumstances outside of our awareness. And all of that, of course, is initiated and activated and controlled by our nervous system. I mean, we don't have to think about the fact that we're doing that. And so for me, that was huge because it kind of demoted, if you will, the ever powerful brain and then included the body as part of the conversation. Yet I didn't specifically learn about the heart until a bit later. Really the documentation of how much more energetically powerful the same kind of electromagnetic energy that's coming out from our body is being sent and received by our heart. So when we're even just thinking about kind of this internal sensor and this intuition and our kind of guidance and how we're being kind of directed through the world, right? Using all of these energetic sensors that we can't even see. And we see that it's our heart that's able to gather the greatest amount of information and then send it very quickly up to our brain, which then our brain uses in terms of our interpretation and how we are then going to react and show up and navigate ultimately that moment. So for me, that was scientifically so hugely important. And also it was a personal invitation to continue, because at that point in time, I saw all of the different ways I was so disconnected from my body in general, because my nervous system was so dysregulated, because I was so consistently overwhelmed with stress and undersupported, that I was still at that point. So I'd had this information in my mind that the heart was important, yet I was still kind of rebuilding my foundational connection back to my body and back to safety. And again, so important, because when we are in that grounded state, like you're saying, when we take those 90 seconds to slow and deepen our breath, to maybe right? Draw to our attention to our heart, envisioning a light, or just kind of coordinating our physiological energy in that moment. Not only are we physically healthier, our immune system is more resilient, our nervous system is more resilient. When we're in that safe and grounded state of presence, right now, even going back to this concept that we were talking about earlier of interdependence, right now, when I have the safety and security to be grounded in myself, now I have more of the opportunity to be myself, to authentically express myself to the world. And when my nervous system is sending out now those signals of coherence, now the message that everyone is getting around me is shifting from what was probably a message of that I am activated, right? I'm stressed out. My nervous system is dysregulated, to one of now coherence, of safety, of security. And this is not only groundbreaking in my own individual life as I try to create and develop more emotional intimacy in my own relationships. In my opinion, this is empowering for all of us, right? Yeah. This is now the space where we can say, because I say a million times, probably a day even, how much we can't control other people. It's one of the most annoying, frustrating things of our human existence, because we can't.
Yeah.
However, right, the kind of like back door is our energy that is communicating to other people. And this is where the title itself of this idea of being the love, really scientifically, if we want to map on this concept, it's being in that state of heart coherence, quite literally then is sending signals of love out to the world around us. What greater impact then for the many of us that do, for understandable reasons, feel powerless about everything that they can't control? How much more empowering is that message and that space? Because that is now the scientific reality that we are living in.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, it's fascinating how the simplest things are most often the most powerful. You know, I remember experimenting with the whole, I think it was A Course in Miracles. You know, this is probably like 15 years ago. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to give everything love. And it's crazy. Like, I didn't expect anything to change. I was very cynical at the time. And it was crazy how things just changed. Like, they just changed when I chose just to give love. And now my default setting, especially if someone triggers me or something happens, I'm like, I'm just going to send you love. I'm just going to send you love. And, you know, for years I was like, is it actually doing anything? And then I just kept paying attention. I'm like, wow, look at the difference. It's so incredibly powerful. And I just interviewed Bruce Lipton this morning, and we talked about how I was watching his conference on Gaia, which is called The Great Convergence. And he talks about how Newton made this in 1927, made an agreement with the Catholic Church that they would just, science would focus on what is seen, matter, and they would focus on the energy. And I feel like that's why we're at this time right now where people like you are breaking the silo. We have to get out of our silo and see how everything, you know, connects together. Now, I'm super aware of your time, and I want to talk about trauma, because I feel like this is something that is a really, for probably the want of a better word, a hot topic, especially in, you know, the world that I work in. And one of the things that I notice a lot is when we pick up on something, and it was shadow work first, and now I'm seeing it's trauma, we pick up on something, and although it's very valuable and something we need to work on and be aware of, it's like we overdo it. We spend so much time in this place of shadow or trauma where, you know, we are, our focus is creating our reality, you know? So the question, you know, for me, what I would love simplified is like, how do we heal our trauma bonding? How do we heal this so we're not constantly trying to fix, solve, heal, so that we can get back to the game of living and creating, you know, beautiful, functional relationships?
I think, and as often I do, simplify, change the journey healing, right, into two steps. And the first simplified step will always be become aware. Becoming aware of all of the subconscious part of our mind that is creating our patterns, of all of our relational patterns, right? See ourselves, like be that, like you were describing yourself, like that observational awareness where we're like, oh, don't do that thing, right? Become that state of consciousness so that then we could take that second step, which is make new choices, right? Actually begin to show up differently. Now, I'm intentionally, again, simplifying change, but also emphasizing that second step of embodying new choices. What a lot of us think, pivotal word here, is a new choice or is helpful on our healing journey is thinking, right? We think we're analyzing ourselves. We think we're reading all the new self-help books and gaining all of this information. And we think we're bettering ourselves, or that's healing. And even back to like what you're talking about, like how we got kind of diverged on the path. And I would cite, right, Descartes and his famous saying, "I think therefore I am," as being a whole big part of this too, this overemphasis on thinking. And I think for a lot of us, how many times can I say think, that in and of itself, thinking has become an adaptation, meaning we think to keep ourselves out of the embodied presence or the state of awareness, us being conscious to what is there. Because what is there for a lot of us is a lot of discomfort that we've been carrying for a long time. Though because we think it's, we're analyzing ourselves. This is an action of self-awareness, right? I'm doing the work because I'm endlessly thinking and overanalyzing my behaviors and interpreting them. I'm still thinking.
Yeah.
And continuing to emphasize the body and how foundational it is on this journey as we become aware of maybe the fact that we do overthink, right? We are always thinking and ruminating and for great purposes because I'm analyzing myself, right? We become aware of what's happening so that then if we do determine that we are an overthinker who's always down the next rabbit hole of self-analysis, a lot of our embodied steps might be disconnecting that attention from our thought and becoming more present to our body, right? Where all those needs live that we talked about earlier, where our emotions live and those signals, right? So for a lot of us, and again, to answer then simply this question of when we become aware and become that state of consciousness more often than not throughout our day so that we can always be in that empowered space of making choices, then in my opinion, we are living consciously. Because I am always, I will never define, because I don't think there is a definition of this utopian state of done. What does healed mean, right? I don't think any of us could agree on, okay, this is what, because I don't want to ever give the idea that that stuff goes away, because for a lot of us, it doesn't. I'm healed, yet I still might have racing thoughts in any given moment, right? I'm healing, yet I still might be compelled to say or do that old dysfunctional habit. I'm healing, yet I might still say or do that old dysfunctional habit and then come back and take accountability for it later. And I'm still healing. Right? It doesn't negate, because those old habits are still, as I talk about them in the book, neurobiologically wired, which means they're etched in. There's hardware. They're changeable, but they're not going to go away overnight. So I'm healing when I'm able to be in my state of conscious awareness more often than not, so I can make the choices that align in each changing moment, because that's another area that we don't actually get to predict what happens next.
Yeah.
So if we continue to stay grounded in myself in each moment, then I can gain that guidance that comes again from within, not from what everyone else is doing or what even I said to do, because I will always be the first person that I might as well offer here. Don't just do as I say. Yeah. So much of this journey is not about just because someone else, so much I've done in my life was because someone else said to, not because each of us carry all of the wisdom that each of us need inside. So I will be the first even to say here, do not just listen and, you know, take my journey step by step because it worked for me. My goal is to empower each and every one of you listening to truly know that you do have that space inside, to peel back the conditioning so that you can meet that space, inhabit that space, and spend more time than not in that space moving forward.
Oh my goodness, I love that so much. And I feel like it's something I am always reminding people, you know, like, just because you perceive someone is something doesn't mean it's true. Success leaves clues. And if I've learned one thing, you know, with the success that I've created in my life, it's about perseverance. It's just about getting back up. It's not that I've fixed anything completely or solved all my problems or a perfect human. In fact, I'm far from it. I'm just willing to make more mistakes. I'm willing to be uncomfortable. I'm willing to be more authentically myself. And I love that. I think it's always the stories of very successful people that they share about, you know, when they fell down. You know, I remember a Tony Robbins story when he said once, and this is a number of years ago, he used an example of being on the plane and the internet didn't work and he lost his shit at, and he's telling us, like, I lost my shit at everyone on the plane. I was basically telling the pilot to turn the fuck around and you know, and then he's like, and then it dawned on me. Like, I'd just gone unconscious, you know? So I went back into that place and I found gratitude for the moment. Oh, okay, I can't work, so I'm just going to meditate. And I think that it's so important that we all understand that we are not perfect. Like, we are not going to be done. Like, I will sometimes even joke, I'm pretty confident that even the Dalai Lama has dark moments. Like, I'm pretty confident. And like, if he hasn't got it nailed, then we're not going to, you know, we're not going to be fixed in our lifetime either. And oh my goodness, I have so many other questions for you, but I really want to respect your time. So, Nicole, Dr. Nicole, thank you so much for being here. How can people go out there, get your books? How can they connect with you on social media?
Well, thank you. This has been truly an honor. I probably could have continued to chat away with you too, Emma. So yes, my new book can be found pretty much anywhere. Books are retailed. I do know that a lot of local bookshops have them, and I'm a big fan of supporting local. So of course, go check out your local bookstore. I have a website up, howtobetheloveyouseek.com, that does highlight several booksellers that I do know will be carrying copies of the book if you have any trouble finding it. I have my own website, theholisticpsychologist.com, that has all information about the other books and my membership, Self-Healer Circle. And of course, across all of the different social media platforms at this point, there is some presence of the Holistic Psychologist, whether it's TikTok or X, or of course, it all started on the Instagram account. There's a YouTube. I always forget Threads. I mean, pretty much any account you might have, pop in the Holistic Psychologist and you will see some version, hopefully, of our community there.
Yeah, I love it. And the reels that you do, like,
they're fun.
They are so good because they're just real life. They're like, yep, been there. Yep, done that. Yep.
All inspired by our real lived experience.
Yeah, I just love it. Thank you so much for being here with me. I've just had the best time chatting to you. Thank you everyone for listening. And I absolutely trust you got what you needed from today's episode. Please go and check out Nicole's work in all the other places because it's epic. And thanks for being here with us today. Thanks again. Thanks everyone for being here all the way to the end of the podcast. I hope you got lots of value out of it. I certainly had a lot of fun doing it. Could I please ask that you share this podcast with friends if you found it valuable? And also, bonus points, could you leave a review for me as well on Apple? It would be greatly appreciated. If at any point you would like to be on the podcast or you've got questions that you'd like me to discuss on the podcast, by all means, get on my socials and DM me. Everything you need is there in the show notes. Have an awesome day. Bye for now.